www.ReachMD.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is George Bush running for president 2 years ago, trying to get the United Steelworkers of America to vote Republican for a change.
Steel is an important job issue. It's also an important national security issue.
Bush campaigned hard in once solidly Democrat steel-producing states like West Virginia, and a lot of people say he wouldn't be president today if West Virginia hadn't gone for Bush. This past week, outside the White House, the steelworkers called in their chips.
Let's hear it as loud as you can, because I want George Bush to hear it.
40% for 4 years. 40% for 4 years.
Yesterday, President Bush announced he won't give them exactly what they want. Instead of 40% tariffs for 4 years, it's 30% for 3 years. But these are still the most punishing tariffs in decades. And these from a president who considers himself Mr. Free Trade. Already, the European Union is saying it will retaliate big time. Connection listeners, is protecting American steel worth the risk of a trade war, especially when America needs its allies for a war on terrorism? And dealing with your own pocketbook, are you willing to pay a bit more for your car, for your fridge, for your dishwasher to help out American steel? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, a little later on in this hour, we'll hear from the trade spokesman for the European Union. Anthony Gooch will be calling in. We have with us at the University of California at Berkeley Business School, Paul Tiffany. He is professor of public policy and global management. He's also the author of a book called The Decline of American Steel. And on a cell phone, in a car, on his way to the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., we have the president of the United Steelworkers of America, Leo Gerard. Mr. Gerard, hello.
Hi, how are you?
We hope to be getting you into a studio in just a few minutes. I understand your plane was delayed.
That's right. I'm at 17th and Pennsylvania Avenue, so I should be there shortly.
Is this the right thing for America, what Bush has done, or is it simply the right thing for American steelworkers?
No, I think it's absolutely the right thing for America. The American steel industry currently is one of the most productive steel industries in the world. Our problem is that we don't have a level playing field. There's a Commerce Department study that's been endorsed by the Commerce Department of the current administration and the previous administration that has been able to identify 30 years of predatory practices. And the key point is it said that the reason that the American steel industry has been targeted is they've been targeted by, quote, market distorting subsidies and countervail measures.
But if other countries, if other companies can make steel at a lower price than unionized, large, integrated, old-fashioned American steel mills,
well, look,
shouldn't
look
they have
your,
the opportunity to sell those?
Your language is pretty biased, and let me be very blunt. Your language is uninformed.
Okay, go.
These are sophisticated, high-technology mills that can produce steel now at anywhere up to 2.4 man-hours per ton, whereas 15 years ago it took almost 10 man-hours per ton. These are not old-line industries. These are high-tech, highly efficient facilities where very often you put in the raw material at one end of the plant and you don't see it again until it comes out, except it's managed by computers, and we can roll that steel at the other end to 1/10,000th of an inch.
So why aren't those mills competitive?
Let me just finish, please. The reality is that the newest modern mini mills, who are the other ones that we've been compared to, are also in the same financial piece that we are. They can't even earn the cost of their capital. The reason that we're in this predicament is because there's a global overcapacity in almost every geographic region of the world except Canada and the United States, and that overcapacity is unbelievably subsidized. Let me give you one very quick example. A European company that has just created 2 weeks ago called Arcelor has, in the creation of that company, has the company's retiree health care cost, its retiree pension plan cost, the environmental cleanups of consolidation, plus subsidized inputs of coal, iron ore, and natural gas. It's unfair to ask American steelworkers who are playing by free market conditions and to compete against the conditions from other parts of the world, such as the one I just identified, and that's going on in China, it's going on in Korea, it's going on in Japan, it's going on in the European Union. In a recent Bloomberg report, the number two man in the Russian steel industry said that they were keeping 1,000 Russian steel companies who were, quote, industrially brain dead on life support with government subsidies. So that what we're asking for is not a bailout or a handout. We're asking for a level playing field. And if we have a level playing field and everybody's playing by the same rules, we'll win.
Mr. Girard, stay with us. I want to bring Paul Tiffany into the conversation. Paul is professor of public policy and global management at Berkeley's business school. And when we talk about a level playing field, Paul, it seems like there is so much government involvement in Europe, in Russia, in Japan, in all different countries' steel production, that it's impossible to sort of peel it all away and talk about something that's genuine free trade.
Well, certainly to a degree that's true. Steel historically has played a role in the countries that produce it much greater than its economic significance. But much of this has to do with the fact that steel workers, metal workers in Europe and other parts of the world have always been politically active, large numbers, and they have affected public policy. When you look at aspects of a level playing field, though, as Mr. Girard mentioned, I think it is difficult to determine clearly, precisely, exactly just what that consists of. The United States subsidizes its industry to a degree. Europe subsidizes its steel industries, as do Asian firms. The question, though, I think is not a matter of whether or not it's a level playing field. I think it goes to much more significant issues having to do with how necessary is it to play chicken with the rest of the world over an industry in America that essentially is inconsequential today?
And Leo Girard?
I couldn't disagree more that the steel industry is inconsequential. We're still the largest steel market in the world. And in fact, inconsequential is that in America, if we were to lose our steel industry, you can't make a car, you can't build a building, you can't put in a bridge, you can't build a road. You, in fact, can't even make your own computer without having steel in it. And the fact of the matter is, if we lost our domestic steel industry, the way the world is forming itself up into various cartels, as I pointed out, there's a 50 million ton company being formed in France. There's a number of consolidations in Europe. The Japanese are consolidating. The largest steel company in the world now resides in China. You can well imagine that five or six regions of the world could meet together in Geneva or Brussels and decide how to fix steel prices, just like the oil cartel and does.
Paul Tiffany,
I don't think America should be held hostage both to steel and to oil. When OPEC meets, we shiver.
I hear you. Paul, go ahead.
Well, of course Mr. Girard would say that. He should say that. That's his job to say that. If the American steel industry shut down tomorrow, we would be awash with steel from abroad. There is so much excess capacity in the world today.
Look, that's very short-sighted.
Saving steel workers' jobs who are paid double to triple of others is not the way to take care of America's economy.
Whoa. I'm not going to sit still for you to say that. Steelworkers aren't paid double and triple what others are paid.
How much are they paid compared to paid at Nucor? How much are the United Steelworkers paid compared to non-union mini-mills?
Let me tell you, my friend, you're now showing completely your lack of information. A Nucor worker makes more than a steelworker in our unionized plants. And you better go check your facts. I mean, if you're going to start to spout that, you ought to get informed and speak from true facts and not from some delusion that you're suffering from reading the wrong paper.
Leo Girard,
I find that really offensive.
I'm not going to be able to adjudicate a conversation where one worker is making more than another worker. So I want to try and keep it, if I can, on whether or not.
That's an insult to our members who work hard every day, and they don't get paid nearly enough for the hard work they do. They make about $40,000 a year.
A question that should be raised, though, is what should be the basis of a steel worker's pay?
It has nothing to do with
hard work.
Pay. No, look, it has nothing to do with pay. It has to do with productivity. We can produce steel at the lowest average man hours per ton in the world. We can produce steel with the lowest emissions per ton in the world. We can produce steel with the lowest energy consumption in the world. One of the problems is, and I don't want to chew up all the time on this, but if the only measure of a country's success is how low it can get its workers to work for, how little a wage it can pay them, how little an environmental standard it could have, how little it can do for its society, then I got to tell you, we're going down the wrong path.
Leo Gerard, one of the things that you'll have to do as head of the steelworkers is say to people who don't understand the industry as well as you do that to pay a little bit more for a steel desk or a refrigerator or a car is in fact a good thing, because that's part of how this will play out.
Let me absolutely agree with you that that's part of how it's playing out. And with all due respect, it's playing out like that because the folks who have been the front group for people who have been importing steel illegally into America have been promoting that fear tactic. The 30% tariff, if it translates it into a price increase, all of the models that we've seen from the ITC, from all of the other groups, indicate that it will translate somewhere to a 5 to 6 to 6.5% increase in price. A 6.5% increase in price from, let's call it, December of 2001, won't even bring steel to the price that it was at in 1998. And in 1998, you could buy a ton of steel cheaper than you could in 1980, in $1980. So that if I could buy my car, my toaster, my refrigerator in the year 2000 as cheaply as I could in 1980, then God bless me. But my car is costing a hell of a lot more than that. And it's not because of the price of steel. There's only 700 pounds of steel in the largest SUV. So in a large $50,000 SUV, if the price was totally converted into the price of the vehicle, it would result in about a $35 increase in the price of steel, maybe a dollar, maybe $1 in a fridge or stove, and maybe up to $3 in a refrigerator.
Leo, are you getting anywhere close to the studios there at National Public Radio?
We're on Massachusetts Avenue, and I think I'm just pulling into 635 Massachusetts Avenue.
You know what I'd like to have you do is pocket your cell phone, dash into the studio. We've got a break coming up, so we'll be able to get back to you in about 3 minutes. It'll be
okay.
Nice to have your voice.
What floor do I go to?
There's someone waiting for you right at the front desk.
Okay, I'm there. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Paul Tiffany, just before we go to the break, did President Bush have any choice? There was so much pressure on him.
Of course he had a choice. He always has a choice. He sold out for political short-term gain. I know that. Mr. Gerard knows that. You know that. And all of your informed listeners know that. The states, West Virginia, we know he barely carried. Ohio and Pennsylvania have large numbers of existing plus far more retired steel workers. And if Mr. Bush wants to get reelected in 2004, those states are going to be critical. This was a decision that has everything to do with his political future and very little to do with the United States' economic well-being today. I'm not going to criticize Mr. Gerard for what he's saying. Mr. Gerard should say that. That's his job, to protect his members. But I think that when we start talking about extra 5 or 6% on refrigerators and cars, we're missing the bigger issue here. And it has to do with the role of steel in the United States.
We'll get to that when we come back after our break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about an announcement made yesterday by the president that there will be punitive tariffs put on much of the steel that's imported into the United States in order to provide what the president calls temporary safeguards in order to provide some assistance for the American steel industry. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the American steel industry, and a decision made by the White House, announced by the White House yesterday, to impose tariffs on imported steel. I mentioned a little bit later on in the program, we'll be hearing from the European Union in terms of their perspective. They are not happy about it. Leo Gerard is taking his seat in a studio in the NPR building in Washington. We have with us from California at the University of California at Berkeley Business School, Paul Tiffany. He's the author of a book called The Decline of American Steel. And Paul, while Leo gets settled, I want to just cover a little bit of very recent history. I know that we can go back to those moments when the steel worker became the icon of the American industrialist back in the 50s and on into the 60s. But if we go until just recently, 1998, that was something of a turning point when the Asian economy collapsed, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly affected it, but there are so many variables here. The price of steel as a world-traded commodity obviously has a lot to do with currency exchange rates. The strong dollar that the United States has experienced since the mid-90s has done an awful lot to stimulate foreign producers to sell steel into America. With a strong dollar, foreign steel is less priced cheaper, and nobody buys steel per se. They buy cars, they buy refrigerators, they rent space in office towers. And steel is simply an input to those. Those manufacturers obviously are going to be looking for the lowest cost. And when the dollar is strong and foreign steel is thus priced cheaper, it comes in larger amounts. The downturn in Asia starting in July of 97 had a big impact because everyone in the early to mid-90s was pointing to Asia as the future market of the world. China now produces more steel than the United States. The infrastructure was being built there. And so many firms worldwide were gearing up to supply that part of the world. When you build a steel plant, you have a huge front-end capital cost. You don't just turn the switch and shut it down until the market comes back. Many of those nations that geared up to produce steel for an expanding world market found themselves faced with a slowdown because of the Asian contagion in the 97 and 98. And that steel then sought other homes. The high dollar brought it into America. It came in, displaced a lot of local steel makers. Mr. Gerard is certainly correct in pointing out the difficulties that his union and his industry have had.
And he's with us now, just so we all know. But go
ahead. Yes, I think, what's the number? 31 firms in bankruptcy.
32 today.
32 today.
Yeah, National Steel went into bankruptcy at 8:30.
There's a broader issue, though, as I said, and it is the role of steel in a globalized economy. We should be, as the leading economic player in the world, we are the ones who have to lead the way towards a globalized economic infrastructure, not a protectionist infrastructure. That means there are trade-offs. They're very tough trade-offs. As I indicated before, I think President Bush made a trade-off that has to do with political variables more than anything else. But, you know, surprise, surprise.
But that doesn't necessarily have to be seen as a bad thing. If politics is the art of looking after the interests of hundreds of thousands of people who may be missing out on benefits, and it may not be something that passes muster with the economists at the WTO. I mean, that's the sort of practicality that a politician has to deal with. Leo Gerard, I mean, do you see it that way?
Well, yeah, I see it that way, but I also see it in a way that that maybe our other guests don't see it, and that is free trade and the term free trade have to be sorted out. You can't have free trade and not have any set of values applied to it. Let me deal with the Russian situation. And I don't see Russian workers or our enemies or Japanese workers. What I view is the systems that are needing to be fixed. It's illogical to say to American workers that you need to play by these rules. These are the rules of the free market as we see it in America. And have us improve productivity by 180%, be the most efficient steel workers in the most efficient steel industry in the world, but then go to Russia and have 1,000 steel mills, not steel workers, but 1,000 steel mills that, as they said, are industrially brain dead, but being kept on life support by the Russian system. And then that Russian
system... They're doing that to keep the Russian workers employed. I mean, you have to acknowledge that as a union leader.
I do. And then they bring that steel here to America, and if we can sell it for $200, they'll sell it for $198. If we sell it for $198, they'll sell it to $195 until they destroy the American industry. And if you look at price volatility...
Leo, can I interrupt you for a minute? Because you mentioned, made a comment a couple of minutes ago that I want to try and use to understand this. I'm not as well plugged into it as either you or Paul Tiffany. You said National Steel went into bankruptcy this morning at 8:30.
At 8:30.
What does that mean? Does that mean that the workers who were on shift last night aren't going back on the job, or that they filed for Chapter 11? What does it mean for their benefits?
That means that this morning at 8:30... National Steel, which now has every large steel company, the shakeout of this is roughly, and I want to try and put it all in perspective, 46% of the steel companies that have gone into Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 have been what we call electric arc furnaces, or, quote, mini mills. Every large steel company is in Chapter 11 now, except of the large integrated U.S. Steel.
But their blast furnaces aren't cold, are they?
No. And none of those companies, whether they're mini mills or integrated mills, can earn the cost of capital today. So they're all in what I call a path to oblivion. Today at National Steel, because they're in Chapter 11, the retiree health care benefits of all of those workers are at risk. If the company comes out of Chapter 11 and sheds its debt obligations and sheds its financial obligations, two of those obligations it will attempt to shed is their pension plan commitments and their retiree health care commitments. That will mean that if you take the retirees from National Steel and you add those to those companies that are already in Chapter 7 or 11, we're up to 385,000 retirees and dependents who now have their health care at risk, of which roughly 52% are what we call pre-Medicare eligible.
We'll get a chance to go a little bit further with this later in the program, because this is something that you had specifically asked for help from the president with. He's put it off to Congress. That's another fight for the United Steelworkers. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, you're listening to a story about an industry in some form of flux, in some sort of crisis, in some sort of change. Your thoughts about the president's decision to impose tariffs to help out U.S. Steel. 1-800-423-8255. First to Greensboro, North Carolina, and Jim is on the line. Hello, Jim.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I had a couple of comments. One, I'm a blacksmith. I've worked steel for 25 years directly in a forge. And the product made by the American mills is very superior to the imported materials. I could get into technical reasons for that, but...
Better than German, better than Japanese? Give me something I can understand.
It's far better than particularly the Oriental imports. There's steel is a carbon iron material. It's an alloy of carbon and iron. If the carbon is a lot of steel is made from recycled products. And if the mill is using a hodgepodge of just whatever they can find and throw in there, the finished bar coming out of that mill is that same hodgepodge. It's inconsistent along the length of the bar. In other words, I'll be forging a piece of iron and I'll quench it in a tub of water to cool it. And if it's mild steel, it shouldn't become brittle. But if it has too much carbon in it, it can very easily become brittle. And that is not only dangerous to me as a worker, but it's also dangerous for my product.
So if the steel, steel is so good, Jim, are you saying that right on, with as far as Leo Girard's concerned, that the industry needs the help to stay viable?
Absolutely. To lose that industry to other countries would be a huge loss to our nation. And I think a dangerous loss. If you think back in history to World War II, I doubt that we would have been victorious had we not had the industrial infrastructure to support us. If we give that away to the Soviet Union or to China or whatever country is out there producing mass quantities at low prices, we're leaving ourselves open to things that could be very ugly.
Jim, thanks for your call. We have on the line with us now the trade spokesman for the European Union, Anthony Gooch. Hello.
Hello.
You've had a chance to listen to a bit of the conversation. A quick reaction from you. What's Europe's thinking about the president's decision to impose this 30% tariff?
Well, Dick, I think you can imagine we are very disappointed here in Europe, and I think disappointed is, to say the least, we are extremely unhappy. We've been saying for many, many months now, for over a year, that the solution to the United States' problems in terms of steel was not to shift responsibility onto the rest of the world, but to buckle down and do what is needed to make that industry competitive across the board. The United States has a competitive steel industry in its mini mills. It does not have a competitive industry in many of the biggest steel works, and they know that. But the solution to problems in world trade today is not to shift responsibility onto others, but it's actually to buckle down and sort your own problems out.
Practically, though, what does this mean for Europe? I mean, are you talking about steel mills in Europe, which will now go under? Are you talking about Europe having to deal with steel being dumped in from abroad?
Well, the situation is as follows. The European steel industry, some 20, 25 years ago, started going through a very painful process. In the late 1970s, we had some 1 million steel workers in the European Union. At that time, the European Union was 12 countries. Now we have a European Union of 15 countries, and it's going to get even bigger. And we have a steel workforce of only 250,000. Our steel industry has been through hell and high water to make itself lean, mean, and competitive. And that's the name of the game in today's international trade. In the meantime, what has happened in the U.S.? The U.S. has been protecting itself behind massive barriers already, anti-dumping. There are more than 200 anti-dumping suits out there protecting steel as it is. And this is coming on top of that. Now, in today's day and age, either you become competitive or you go under. But what we can't have is a situation where we have done that painful process and then artificially, through U.S. protectionism, some 16 million tons of world steel that should be going to America this year are shifted onto our market, flood our market, dump our prices, and put competitive people out of business who have been through that situation. Not only that, but it's a double whammy because we have 4 million tons of steel that we export to the United States, which we won't be able to export anymore.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Now to Leo Gerard, who's international president of the United Steelworkers. Do you want to speak back to Mr. Gooch?
Sure. Let me say that again. I don't know where Mr. Gooch is getting his information, but the large integrated mills in America are as efficient as any mill in the world. And the fact is that we've been going through the same painful transition, and our transition has been much more forthcoming than the European Union. We gave up so much steel-making capacity to create a market for imported foreign steel that America can only meet 80% of its own domestic demand. Whereas if I go to the European Union, they have about 140% more steel. They have 40% more than they can consume. And I can take you around the world that Russia has 400% more, Japan 198, Korea 154. The European Union in the 140 range, the Latin Americans about 136. You come to United States and Canada producing about 80%, 85% in Canada of their national demand. We've made the sacrifices. We've opened our markets up to 20% import penetration. But at some point, we cannot, should not, and should not be expected to compete and become the world's patsies so that the countries that are subsidizing, the countries that are keeping their industry on life support, can get to dump that steel in America and destroy America's steel industry. We have,
Mr. Gooch, I'm wondering if in your perspective...
Let me just put the last piece in that I'll give U.S. Steel as an example. And U.S. Steel is a good model for most of the rest of the integrated industry. We can produce steel at U.S. Steel at about 2.4 man-hours per ton. That's world class.
Mr. Gooch, I'm wondering, as I listen to the two of you speak, whether or not we're not headed for the same sort of thing from Europe, that now that the United States has put these tariffs in, that the European countries may, in fact, end up having to do the same thing.
Let me just quickly pick up on what Leo was saying. Let me start off with one thing which we have always recognized, and that is the difficulties that the U.S. steel industry is in. We don't dispute those. And we know what it's like to go through that sort of situation because we've been through it. What we've also done is put a number of very constructive recommendations on the table to the United States in order to deal with this problem effectively. For example, we were the ones who said to the United States, let's sit down at the OECD at an international level and talk about overcapacity in the world steel market. This is a world problem. This is a world issue. So why don't we talk about it at a world level? We did this, but unfortunately, we did this with a gun to everybody's head. And the gun to everybody's head was the threat of a 201. And now the trigger has been pulled.
Of a 201? You mean a tariff being put in?
What I mean is effectively closing the U.S. market, which is what was decided yesterday by
right.
President Bush.
Okay.
So we had a gun to our head, and now the trigger has been pulled. Well, in those circumstances, I don't know what future there is for those discussions at a multilateral level. As far as the situation is concerned with U.S. steel at the moment, frankly, I take issue with the image that Leo is creating that U.S. steel is incredibly competitive and it's surrounded by an island of dumpers. It just doesn't wash and it doesn't hold water. U.S. steel has benefited conservatively from some $16 billion worth of subsidies, unconservative some $22 billion in 1999 figures. Your imports since 1998 have gone down by 33%. Our imports have gone up by 18% in the last 3 years. Now, if you are telling us that suddenly you have a big problem, how come you guys are... your imports are falling massively, and our imports are increasing.
I can answer that very, very easily. And in fact, if the importers have been trying to use this number, and percentages can be very deceiving. The fact is that in 1998, at the peak, and it peaked at about close to 40% import penetration. So if you keep that in mind, the year that Mr. Gooch is referring to, we had import penetration of 38 to 40%. So if they say imports fell by 20% from then, that means imports are still at astronomically high levels. When you keep in mind that we had already opened up, and they'll tell you what the steelworkers' position was and still is, that we are prepared to live with about a 20% import penetration level, 21-22%, because of the fact of what Mr. Gooch has alluded to. There are certain steels now, certain kinds of steel products, that America has no longer had the capacity to produce. So in recognition of that, we've said, as a union, we won't make a lot of noise.
Leo, I have to introduce you. It's Dick Gordon here. We are cutting away for a break. We'll come back and talk further about the difference between domestic steel and imported steel, what it means for the consumers and the steelworkers. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and we're talking about steel. We said goodbye during the break to the trade spokesman for the European Union, Anthony Gooch. My two guests are Leo Gerard, International President of the United Steelworkers of America, and Paul Tiffany, Professor of Public Policy and Global Management, author of a book called The Decline of American Steel. And to both of you, can I just ask that we try and stay as much away from percentages and import percentages and penetration and details of wages and benefits to a kind of a principled understanding of how we ought to regard the industry, Paul, because the case has been made in the last few months that it is now more than ever but has to always be seen as a national security industry. Do you buy that?
No. Argument did prevail in the past. I think Mr. Gerard was quite right about his comments of World War II, perhaps in the 50s. But steel simply does not play the critical role in the American economy today that it has in much of the earlier part of the 20th century. The world has moved on. I think that obviously there's a very one should show compassion and understanding for the people in that industry, for Mr. Gerard's fellow union members as well as anyone else. But steel is not the driver in the American economy. It's other materials. If you look at what's going on now in terms of the war on terrorism, steel is not the dominant factor in that. Other metals are. More sophisticated metals that go into airplanes, I would venture. Do we need to protect a steel industry as a national treasure?
Leo Girard, do we need to protect it as a national treasure?
I want to be respectful, but I'm always amazed at the level of sort of
now be polite,
jingoism.
Leo. Here
I'm going to be jingoism. National security means more than just planes and trains and stuff like that. National security is the national infrastructure, and contrary to what the other guest has said, you cannot build an airplane without steel. You cannot build a computer without steel. You can't build a road or bridge. You can't build a building. You can't build an automobile or any moving vehicle. You can't have a railway system. You can't have anything in America without steel.
But what Paul's saying is that we don't necessarily have to have that
steel from the United States. Here's the problem. I mean, I think that that is very, very dangerous and very, very narrow-minded. Let me deal with it in the form of a national energy policy and oil. This current administration, supported by both Republicans and Democrats, have been arguing for a national energy policy because they don't want the nation to be dependent on foreign oil. The only thing that is as pervasive as oil is steel in our economy. And right now, the Japanese are consolidating their industry. They may end up with two, maybe three, 30 to 35 million ton companies. The Europeans, I was going to ask Mr. Gooch that, they're doing the same thing. They're using all kinds of subsidies and enhancements to do that. The Latin Americans are doing the same thing. The largest steel company in the world is Bo Steel in China. If you take those regional blocks of five or six regions with maybe two to three to four companies each, calling a meeting at some point in the future, they will determine the allocation and the price of steel for America. If you put that next to OPEC meeting on oil, mm-hmm. America becomes very, very vulnerable, and our industrial base will either expand or shrink at the whims of what other people from other nations see as our interest, not what we see as our interest. And that worries me a lot.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Raleigh, North Carolina, Bob's joining us. Hello, Bob.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I understand both sides of the coin. I worked for Republic Steel back in the late 70s through the mid-80s. And unfortunately, I've seen that a lot of the problem in steel is in the management of the companies that run the steel industry, turning mostly a blind eye to the warnings and running to the government saying, you have to help us and bail us out. While protectionism, you know, helps to maintain what we're doing here with the industry, it's not good business. Business 101 states that you understand your market, you supply a product that is not only quality, but what the market wants, and competitively fight for parts of those sales.
Bob, one of the things that the president said yesterday is that these are temporary safeguards, only in place for 3 years, that all the changes that American steel companies will have to make will have to be done in that period of time, and then they're on their own again. Is that good enough for you?
If and only if we don't turn around and in 3 years after that do this all over again. The auto industry has pulled itself out and it's running back into similar situations. But when I was at Republic Steel, Chrysler was going through their major changes, and the government helped to bail them out, and they successfully came out of that. Hopefully the steel industry can do the same, but I see a lot of problems, you know, if we just hide behind the government on this one.
Leo.
Could I ask the guest a question myself?
Shoot.
Sure.
Let me sort of put it in its context and then ask the question. It's undisputed that the U.S. steel industry is one of the most efficient industries. It can produce steel at the lowest man hours per ton, lowest emissions per ton, and the lowest energy consumption per ton. Using those three, we ought to be a success. In addition to that, we demand as citizens decent wages, pensions, health care, provided by the employer as opposed to the state. And we want clean air and we want clean water. Is it fair to say that an American steelworker then should be asked to compete with a Russian worker who's 8,000 companies are on life support, who doesn't have any environmental concerns, doesn't have no concerns about clean air, clean water, has free coal, has free iron ore, has a gas subsidy, and doesn't pay any taxes to the state at the local or national level. Is it fair for us to be told that that's your benchmark that you have to get to?
Leo, you should have your own radio show. They're good questions. But the point that Bob is making, Bob, if I can paraphrase, is that we've been here before, that steel has asked for tariffs and bailouts before.
But isn't the proper thing is to reduce the world domestic overcapacity, and then use I'm not a free trader, but let me play the devil's advocate. Use the president's terminology to establish free market conditions and a level playing field around the world at levels of production that are much closer to the national demand. If we do that, we can win. But we're the only ones playing by the rules, and no one else is.
Bob, quickly.
Well, I look at it as if I've got a product, say a pet rock, and if I can make it efficiently and cleanly and pay my employees, but if nobody wants to buy it, you know, why should I continue making these? Why don't I go into the markets in the areas where I can be competitive in the specialty steels? I look at Timken Steel in Canton, Ohio. They're very successful, but they've gone through the process of saying, here's where our market is, here's where our product is, and here's where we can sell what we can make. Even though we have the technology to efficiently and cleanly produce tons and tons of steel, we're going to focus on this area and be successful at it.
So, Paul Tiffany, are we talking about an American steel industry that is in some way divided, where there are these tremendous efficiencies and also inefficiencies?
Well, there are certainly differences between the integrated mills and the mini mills. I think Mr. Girard's earlier comments about oil and steel being equal in the American economy are simply absurd. Steel simply does not play the role in the American economy that it used to.
Tell me what you can make without steel.
I'm going back to my point that there is steel. The world is awash with steel. There is no need to protect this industry. If we start steel, why don't we protect every single industry, and each nation should only produce everything itself and have no trade? The grandchildren of steel workers in America today are going to be much better off with the policies of open markets that the United States has espoused. We are the most competitive economy in the world. We have the best technology in the world. We have the best performing industry in the world. And when we put up impediments by protecting one industry that generates retaliation, it sets all that back. Steel is not.
We're going to go to Cary, North Carolina, where Rebecca's standing by. Rebecca, hello.
Hi.
Tough to elbow your way in, but go for it here.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I know we're limited. Yesterday, when the president imposed these restrictions and pointed out they were temporary, he said that, well, this will give the steel industry a chance to, you know, retool and do all this stuff. But with Mr. Girard saying, you know, that it's so productive and so competitive, where does the industry have to go? I mean, how is this going to be accomplished, or what is going to be accomplished in these 3 years?
I think the industry has to consolidate. Let me say that I think there are too many steel companies, and the market is too fragmented. I was going to say earlier that when the other speaker was saying about finding your niche, the carbon steel market for America has been a growing market. We now consume more steel than we did 10 years ago, but our domestic share has been shrinking because we've ceded that to imports. I think that we can play a role in a consolidation. I think one of the big things, and I commended the administration for taking on that challenge, one of the big things that has to be done is to deal with the global overcapacity that finds its way to truly the only free open market, and that's the U.S. and Canada. The other thing that I think is tremendously important is that we try to level the playing field on a number of important factors that American workers should not be asked to reduce their environmental standards and not asked to reduce their wage and benefit standards to compete with Russian industries that are on life support. I think that there's a tremendous opportunity here to strengthen the steel industry, to strengthen the global steel industry by reducing the global overcapacity. And we're willing to play a role in that.
Rebecca, thanks very much for your call. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Leo Gerard, I know you have to leave shortly, so I'd like to, if I can, try and bring this to some kind of conclusion with both yourself and with Paul. What if, as a result of this, as Mr. Gooch is warning, the U.S. tariffs on imported steel cause a trade war and people start turning around, pointing the finger at U.S. steelworkers and saying, we were almost out of recession and look what you guys did to us?
I don't think that will happen. And part of that is that everyone knows that there's a global overcapacity. I find it pretty ironic that Paul was saying that America shouldn't worry about whether or not it has a steel industry when every other nation in the world is scrambling to have one because they know how important it is. I guess my comment is that America was much more willing to risk a trade war over bananas, which we don't grow, process, or produce, and went to the wall over that and didn't have one job in America. I think that trying to level the playing field so that we have a fair shot in steel and trying to reduce the global overcapacity in steel that exists everywhere but America, I think is the right thing to do. And I'm proud of our membership for fighting for that. We need to go on to try and get their health care protected. I'm going up to the House and Senate today to meet with people to try to get that idea rolling and get it moving in the House, because right now we've got a program of tariffs that will take care of the companies, but we don't intend to just stand there and leave the workers behind.
Leo Gerard, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Leo Gerard is International President of the United Steelworkers of America. Paul Tiffany is still with us. Paul, I want to try and get some of your thoughts pulled together to sum up the hour, because you started out talking about this being, in effect, a political decision. But I'm drawn to ask you again, did Bush have a choice if there was that much pressure on him? Because if you look around at the people complaining, there aren't very many people complaining in the United States. The industry seems happy. The union seems happy. Those Rust Belt swing states seem happy. Seems to be a fairly shrewd move.
Well, of course he had a choice. It's called leadership. Part of the role of a president is to display leadership in economic areas. The United States is the country that has to lead the world in terms of opening up markets. If globalization is, in fact, going to continue, it's going to continue because the United States of America shows the way. When we take petty moves like this to protect a relatively small industry, similar to steel, it sends the wrong signals. As I said before, Dick, I believe that the president is simply shoring up his political weakness in the industrial states. I don't think he's showing the leadership that we elected him for. I think another.
You think
point
in the long run he's going to pay for this?
It all depends on what the Europeans do. This is, as Yogi said, deja vu all over again. I think it's interesting that both Bob and Rebecca, those who called in, pointed out that management has not done its share. I don't want to lay the blame on the United Steelworkers of America. I think there's enough blame to go around to everyone.
Paul, thanks so much for being with us this hour. Paul Tiffany is professor of public policy and global management at the Berkeley Business School. We heard earlier from Anthony Gooch, trade spokesman for the European Union, and Leo Gerard, international president of the United Steelworkers of America. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.